When we paused for a moment, you were about to tell me a bit about your dad's participation with the labor Zionist movement.
Well, he was actually one of our competitors in the industrial uniform business. Involved my father, Morris Shaver. There was a company, Central Overall, who were a pretty big a garment rental company, like I showed you some of the garments back there. And he befriended my father and I got him involved in labor Zionism. In the 30s, well, there was no Israel, and the Zionist movement started the turn of the century with Theodor Herzl. I don't want to give you a irrelevant history, but
please,
okay,
it's good for someone reading if they if someone reading this and they're a casual reader who do not understand what you're speaking of. It's good to have it on the record, and I do happen to know.
Okay, well, Theodor Herzl was a an Austrian, I guess, was from Vienna, and he was a reporter for the Naya something press, something, the New Press, and was sent to cover the Dreyfus trial in France when Dreyfus was a Jewish army officer in the French army and was accused of espionage and giving secrets to the, I guess, to the Germans. And he was, it was a big commotion in France. Who was the author? Jacques Hughes.
Well, largely speaking, Dreyfus was railroaded.
Yes, and he was exonerated later.
Sure.
And the true culprit was a non-Jewish army officer who I don't know what really happened with him finally, but it was such a turmoil in France. There were riots in the streets, and it was you know, unbelievable. Well, anyway, Herzl witnessed this trial and the turmoil. Come on, Jacques Hughes. Who wrote Jacques Hughes?
I'm sorry to say I do not know.
Oh, yes, you do. Yes.
Possibly.
You know. No, come on, you guys know history. You know, you're okay.
Not that one.
Not that one, okay. I'll forgive you.
Though I understand about the Dreyfus trial and impact of it.
There's a novel that he wrote, Nana, about a prostitute, a French prostitute, became a movie. It's before your time, I guess. Okay. All right, we'll drop that
it's
one.
It's not Prost.
What?
Sorry.
Forget it.
Not know.
Anyway, so Herzl started the Zionist movement, turn of the century, and he was trying to interest monarchs in Europe to support the idea. He didn't get very far. And anyway, and there was very little positive reaction in the Jewish community. Particularly American Jews and German Jews felt their patriotism to their country would be impugned if they got involved in the Zionist movement, and for years did not stayed away from it. And even in the 30s, as late as the 30s, in Texas, there was a a Jewish organization that was anti-Zionist, that was fought against it, and some wealthy German Jews fought it. The owner of the New York Times was still to this day is really unfriendly to Israel. You would have thought the Holocaust would have cured a lot of this attitude, but it hasn't and didn't. Any rate, in Michigan, in in Michigan, there was a lot of anti-Semitic activity. The Catholic priest from Royal Oak,
Father Coughlin,
first started out as a supporter of FDR, and after the first term, got disaffected from him, and attacked FDR, and later on joined the isolationist movement and so forth. In Michigan, there was an organization called the Black Legion, which was a northern Ku Klux Klan, in effect. And, of course, on the fringes of that was the Chicago Tribune owner, McCormick.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. They weren't quite anti-Semitic, but they were really right-wing, and they were isolationist in terms of American foreign policy. And, you know, they blamed the attack in Pearl Harbor on FDR, that FDR fomented it in order to bring the United States into war. You know, similar to what went on with 9/11.
Mm-hmm.
No, this wasn't the terrorists or Al-Qaeda. It was
right.
Bush. Anyway, in that atmosphere, he got involved in the labor Zionist movement. He became a fundraiser. The Jewish Communities Federation campaign is the main fundraising body for the Jewish community. Well, the Histadrut had their own independent fundraising organization.
If you could explain briefly what Histadrut is.
Histadrut, it was the labor federation, started in 1922-23 in Israel. It was made up of a number of political parties, and they were the core, the driving force of the colonization of Israel, the founding of kibbutzim. You know what a kibbutz is.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, I don't have to go into that. Anyway.
So there was a branch, or there were, I don't know how to describe it, a branch of Histadrut or support organization in this area that your father joined.
That and was head of, you know, not only joined it, but he was the leader of it and so forth. And he was the head of the Histadrut campaign until he died, and that was my inheritance. I inherited all of his cards, fundraising cards, and I pursued them till the people stopped contributing or the campaign went out of business. And they raised, it wasn't like the Federation, the Jewish Federation funds, which had a broader band of support. But anyway.
So he's not only a Zionist, he's a labor Zionist, as well as
a fundraiser, a leader, and so forth. And he took me on a trip to Palestine in 37, where he was a substitute delegate to the World Zionist Congress in Basel, Switzerland, at that time. And I was 15 at the time, and it was most inspiring and eye-opening and so forth. In the meantime, I had been going to Hebrew school all along, so I studied Hebrew, and I still have my hand in a little bit.
And what school was this?
United Hebrew Schools.
Where?
The place I went to was Philadelphia. It was Tuxedo and Homer. That was the branch of the United Hebrew Schools. It was a network of schools that was supported by the Jewish community. In fact, one of the first ones is right here on Kirby and John R. or something. The building is still standing, and it's not, I don't know. I don't think it's used as anything. But from that trip to Palestine, in 37, we were there about 3 weeks. It was very exciting, very inspiring. Here was a dormant Jewish people who had, you know, gone through 2,000 years of persecutions and migrations and so forth, were trying to reestablish themselves as a nationality. And when I came back, I joined this left-wing group. They were part of the Histadrut. They had a branch here, and the goal of that group was to get American Jews here to move to Palestine and join a kibbutz, which I visited on my last trip. I still have the contacts with the people and so forth.
So that year for you was an epiphany.
Yes, absolutely.
And you came back a changed person.
I came back, and I left the Boy Scouts. I was a first-class Boy Scout, and I didn't go to the Eagle level, but I joined this Chalutz, which means pioneer group. And that was a cultural uplifting in terms of music and reading and literature. It was more than a club. It was a movement, okay, that in the European sense of movement. In fact, that's one of the words in Yiddish, Bewegung, meaning movement. That it was all-encompassing. When you belonged, you belonged to them and they belonged to you. It was a... how can I describe it in a better word than that? I can only tell you in Hebrew and in Yiddish. That won't help.
Well, I mean, it wasn't, as my understanding of it, is it wasn't a utopian society.
Yeah, it was. Yes, yes.
Was it?
They
okay.
were. They were. They wanted to construct a utopian society. You put your finger on it exactly. These were collectives, no private property within the group. The group owned everything. And, you know, they went a little berserk on that score, and it was their undoing. But from the leadership of the Israeli community came from this group. They were devoted patriots, okay? That was the story. Anyway, I still had intentions of making Aliyah, which is immigrating to Palestine, even when I was at Michigan. And I started studying agriculture. Not agriculture, agriculture, but I can't reach out for the word that I want.
Something beyond farming?
Yeah, farming, scientific farming and so forth. However, I ran into chemistry, and that was my undoing.
While you were in high school?
No, in college.
In college.
At Michigan. Okay, and I was a good student in my, I got to tell you this story later on, but in my freshman year, I got freshman honors at Michigan. Okay, and anyway, when I ran into chemistry, and I was terrible at it. And I had a close friend who later on became he was also a member of this group and was in my Hebrew school class, who was a MIT professor and who won a it's like the Nobel Prize in science. And he was trying to get me through this chemistry class. It's like I am today with a computer. I got a bad teacher and I'm a bad student, but he was a good teacher. And anyway, after that calamity with chemistry, I switched to something easy, economics. Okay, that was more my cup of tea.
Well, we've segued quickly into your college, so I'd like to step back again. And when you graduated from high school, were there any other, you know, now I'm stumbling a bit. Let me rephrase. So we've got you through United Hebrew Schools. That's where your formal K through 12 education. By the time you hit 15, you had joined the group that you discussed related to history.
Yes.
Right. And at this point, you're about to enter college, and you've spoken about chemistry. But when you went into college at that time, what were your plans?
I wanted to prepare for a life in Palestine, okay? I wanted to acquire some skills that would be useful, okay? And this was not law, not medicine, not accounting. So it had to do with agriculture, really, and so forth. But I flubbed out. I really fell on my ass. And then I switched back into economics, which was reasonable for me, for my mind. Okay.
What did you see your future as at that time? Still going to migrating?
Yeah. At that point, yes. Until I got into the U.S. Army, that cured me of of adventures in Palestine. Okay, and so forth. So,
so you did finish a degree at Michigan in economics.
Right.
And then I know by your record that in 43 you were enlisted or drafted into the Army.
I enlisted and was drafted, a little of each. I told you that story. The Army said to college seniors, as I was a senior at the time, that if you would enlist in the enlisted reserve corps, we'll let you get your degree, and then we'll call you up. So immediately, 1 month later, they called up the enlisted.
After you graduated.
Yeah, you can't trust this government. You know that. Hasn't changed.
Yeah.
Anyway.
Yeah.
So.
But at the time you entered the Army, you were still considering that your future was in Israel.
Yes. Yes.
And you say the Army cured you of that. Could you explain?
The Army is a... Have you been in service at all?
Yes, Marine Corps.
Well, Marine Corps. Hey, that's the super service. That's not the service. They made all the discipline, and I wasn't used to that. I came from a middle-class Jewish family, an only child, and I was spoiled and so forth. So... I didn't like taking orders. That was not my cup of tea. And the discipline of this organization or of this movement was you adhered to the discipline of the group. You know, there wasn't a commanding officer like the Army, but you had the group pressure would push an individual into doing things he may not have done by choice. Okay, that was really the long and the short of it. And in the meantime, the Army pulled all these students out of the colleges, and at that time, the students were probably 80-90% male. And the colleges were screaming, "You're putting us out of business." They didn't have women students. So the Army acceded to their request, started a program called Army Specialized Training Program. They gave GIs a test, and if you pass this test, they would send you back to a college to study an assortment of subjects. You had a choice of what you wanted to study. And I had a talent for languages, so I was sent to City College of New York, where I chose to study Russian. Now, even that time, I wanted to study Arabic, but Arabic program was full. They had one college in the East, and I don't remember the name of it, where they taught Arabic. So it still shows that I was still interested in making Aliyah, immigration to Israel. But I couldn't study Arabic, so I picked. In college, I had studied 2 years of German, which is very close to Yiddish in terms of language. And so I took the exotic Russian choice, and I studied Russian at City College of New York.
And then the Army placed you in counterintelligence.
Well, it was not quite so simple or so easy, but yeah, I ended up in counterintelligence headquarters, GHQ, Tokyo. So MacArthur and I straightened out the Japanese. We helped them build a better car.
Now, that's interesting, though, because that, of course, is during the era of the beginnings of the Cold War.
Yes. And one of the concerns, the Russians had an embassy in Tokyo at the time, and I was in counterintelligence. We didn't understand why they had so many people in the Russian embassy in Tokyo. According to the American view, they didn't warrant that. There was no reason for it. And, we were suspicious of their activities, needless to say, and whatnot. Then, after that, I spent about a year in Tokyo, and that was a beautiful country. I got enough points to be discharged. So, and Columbia University started a graduate school of Russian studies called the Russian Institute. It no longer exists. It's part of their I can't think of the name.
Well, it's okay. Colleges, units like that morph. They usually do not lose the unit, but it morphs into another name, doing the
exactly.
same thing.
To foreign affairs, it became part of their foreign affairs thing. And this was the first graduate program in Soviet studies. Actually, because I was an economics major, Soviet statistics were fraudulent. Okay, they just published shit that was, we were really being trained to prove that by other means. There are different ways you can come to conclusions. Well, we did research on Soviet statistics, and when they had a bad year, they didn't publish. It was a phony. All this ideology, this bunch of crap. Anyway, I spent 2 years studying Russian history, Russian geography, language I had adequate for their purposes anyway, and the Soviet economy. And that gave me a master's in economics.
What was your motivation for entering Columbia and getting a master's degree? This was on your own volition,
yes,
I assume.
Yes, sure. Well, a college, a BA is not enough. You got to have more. This is part of the Jewish orientation towards learning and development, okay, and I was part of that, and it fit the background that you know I had had in the Army and mm-hmm. so forth.
What did you want to? What did you want? What was your goal at that time when you entered? Right.
All right. Good question.
Besides the fact you were greedy about education for yourself.
Well, okay. I really wanted to go into the Foreign Service.
Ah.
Now, at that time, the Foreign Service was the repository of the elite Anglo-Saxon Protestant New England segment of society, okay? And, you know, here's a little Jewish kid. What right did he have? I passed the written exam, and then I didn't pass the oral exam. When was I naturalized? Why should they even think that I was not native, as I was? And let's see, what else did they ask me?
Now, these are entrance exams for Columbia.
No, not Columbia. Foreign Service.
Ah, okay.
I'm finished with Columbia.
Oh, we're,
I got my degree and so forth. Now I'm looking around for a job in Washington.
But when you started, just to be... To be precise, so I understand, when you started Columbia, when you began your study for a master's degree at Columbia, you were looking ahead to Foreign Service at that time?
I think so, yeah. I think that's right. And what else?
Were you one of a few Jewish students at Columbia at that time? Were they more open about this?
No. Columbia, after the war, the GI Bill brought in a plethora of Jewish students, which helped this country, the economy, as part of the growth that took place after the war, had to do with the crop of college students that went through the GI Bill. That was tremendous. The professors remarked at the time they had never seen such enthusiasm, diligent students as the people who came on the GI Bill. Everybody had lost 3 to 4 or 5 years of their life. They wanted to make it up, and they were eager beavers, everybody. So it was just an outpouring of, I can't pick on the right word, but you understand what I'm talking
sure.
about.
Sure.
Anyway, I want to get back to my interview. Oh, yeah, they asked me, how could they send a Zionist, you know, I disclosed my affiliations, and this group was really subversive, according to the State Department at that time. How could they send a Zionist to an Arabic country? So my response was, do you send communists to communist countries? Okay, you know, so naturally... I won the battle and lost the war.
So just a sec, let me make sure.
Yeah.
When we paused, you were explaining that you had taken the test for Foreign Service.
Yes.
And there were a couple issues with that. I wonder if you could finish that story for
okay.
us.
Okay, well, I didn't pass the oral exam. I passed the written exam. Tough exam, but listen, I had tough exams. So forth. So I had some other choices for jobs there. Number one, I could have stayed at Columbia, gotten my PhD. I had all the credits I needed, and I would have had to spend a couple of years doing research on a PhD thesis, which was possible because, you know, we didn't need the money. There were just the two of us. Irene was a social worker at that time. I don't know where she... worked for the Red Cross or the Jewish Education Committee. I'm not sure what. But, you know, it was not a financial burden, and my folks were reasonably well set. But the alternatives were stay at Columbia and complete the PhD, which meant I probably would have ended up in academia, teaching Russian. At that time, there were not many Russian departments throughout the universities, so there was a demand for people with this kind of background to teach Russian history, geography, literature, anything about Russian culture and Soviet culture and so forth. That was one alternative. But first, really, to do that properly, I would have had to stay and do my PhD thesis, which fit me. I like that. I like the idea. I wanted to be a PhD. I used to call them Fudniks. I don't know, that was a sort of a funny name. Or there was opportunity in the War Department. They were hiring people. The CIA was just starting. They had sent some of their people to the Russian Institute to get some training. But I didn't apply there. I didn't apply to the War Department. And the State Department, not the Foreign Service, the State Department also had its Russian desk available. So there were jobs there, too. And there was General Lenin in Detroit, and my father saying, look, I'm going to sell a business unless you come in. And there was my wife. We were married, I think, about 2 years, and she says, we've got to have children. You know, we got to procreate. Anyway, so between those choices, I came to Detroit.
Okay, let's step back a little bit again. Since you now have a partner in crime, so to speak, how did you meet Irene, your wife?
Well, we met while I was a student at Michigan. As I said, I was head of the Zionist student Zionist organization. It was called the VUCA. And she was in the national office of this student Zionist organization. She was a graduate of... Hunter College. Junior Phi Beta. Very bright. She's still bright. Hasn't changed a bit. A girl. And we met at a meeting in New York. I went to a meeting, and I don't know if you're interested in all these stories.
A meeting of the junior Zionists?
Yes.
Was she also?
Yes, yes. She was in the national office. She worked in the national office, and she chaired a meeting. And I thought she was so eminently fair in her chairing of the meeting that afterward I asked her to go out to dinner. And that was our first date. And anyway...
Do you happen to know when it was?
When? Yeah, it was during Christmas vacation. What year? Well, it had to be... 43.
Thank you.
I'm not sure. Irene will know. Anyway, so we had our first date. I was a rube from the Midwest, and here was a sophisticated lady, and this organization was a student organization. And there were a lot of very bright people, especially in the New York office and office. People from CCNY, and I don't know if anybody was from Columbia. I don't recall offhand. Maybe I'll interview Irene. She'll fill that in a little more. But the New Yorkers felt that they were the smart people. We had the membership, and they had the brains. So who's going to run whom? And obviously, they felt they were entitled to ride roughshod over us. Irene didn't let them do that. She was chairman of the meeting, and that's what impressed me with her skill in running the meeting and fairness, and resulted in our first date. I got to tell you about the first date, too. So she took me to a nightclub, Cafe Society uptown, which was a sophisticated place, the waiter comes and wants to ask us to drink. Irina orders a scotch and soda. I didn't drink, and that was not my type of thing, and I order a Tom Collins. Irene has never had a scotch and soda since that time. Anyway, it was a memorable program. Come on, what the hell's his name? Who played in Fiddler on the Roof, the lead?
Zero Mostel
entertained at this nightclub. And he had a...
this is in New York City.
New York City. He had a shtick about a speech of an isolationist senator making fun of it, and it ended with, and what the hell were the Hawaiian Islands doing in the middle of the Pacific anyway? Anyway, that was completion of the of his program. But from that time, that was our first date. Then later, when I came to New York City in the Army with the ASTP and the Russian program, I called her up naturally, big city, and we started to date and see one another, and it got hot and heavy. I had a girlfriend in Detroit, and that was sad. I had a, you know the song, if you're not near the girl you love, you'll love the girl you're near. it was one of those deals.
So when did, this might be a dangerous question, when did you get married?
Yeah, that was another story. After ASDP broke up, I was sent to, I think, the engineering corps, and I got pneumonia. I was in a hospital in Mississippi, Camp Shelby, Mississippi, wonderful place not to be. And so I called her up, and I said, Irene, why don't you come down and visit me? You know, Hattiesburg was not such an appetizing place, Hattiesburg, Mississippi. So she gives me a song and dance. She says, look, I got a great job here with the Red Cross. And she says, if I come down to visit you, I have to quit my job, and so forth. So, you know, that was leading with my chin. I said, Irene, come down, we'll get married. She says, "For that I can change jobs," and that's what happened. That's how we proposed, and I got my leave in New York, and her mother made the wedding and real quick, and so forth. So
this would have been 45, 46. Do you remember when?
I should remember.
That's why I said it was a dangerous question.
Yeah, it's all right. Ask Irene. She'll
okay
about that. Yeah. Yeah. And so forth. So, anyway.
So you're at the crossroads.
Well, really not the crossroads. After, you know, the education and whatnot, Irene wanted to have children, and I didn't disagree. But the only way that this was going to be is we moved to Detroit. And I came into General Lennon. And I was not... Okay, go ahead.
So, earlier I said at a crossroads, I guess that's a large metaphor for, you know, did you want to continue your education? You had some options, or did you want to go into the family business? What were your feelings about going into the family business?
I didn't want to, but I felt I had to accede to Irene's wishes, and I wanted kids too. I felt it was under my that I was being utilized, and I had bigger values, bigger abilities, and so forth.
What were your father's feelings about this?
Oh, he was delighted. He was delighted. As I told you, I'm an only son, and he really wasn't that interested in the business. He was interested in this negotiation with the union, with labor contracts, with settling disputes between partners. He really was a lawyer before lawyers came into popularity. And we're not as available, okay, in this period, at least in our circle.
Had he given you, I hesitate to say pressure, but as you were growing up, did he attempt to groom you to go into the business?
No, never did. Mm-hmm. Never did.
Okay, so I was just curious.
As I never did with any of my kids, okay? Yeah,
so 1948, you move back to Detroit with Irene. Time to start a family. You need steady employment, steady income.
Yes.
And I think that's sort of where we left off.
Yeah, well, boom, boom, boom. In 4 years, we had three kids. You know, man, we didn't fool around. So we are, we have a lovely family.
And you had said earlier, too, that you actually enrolled at Wayne State thinking you might continue your education
right.
at the university in Detroit.
Yeah. And later on, I took a job. It was also a sort of a depression. When Chrysler got the government guaranteed loan, remember that period?
Sure, absolutely.
Okay. Business was bad and I was kind of depressed. I took a job with Schoolcraft College teaching economics with their, but again, the night, you know, I couldn't work during the day and teach at night. It was too, I didn't have enough stamina. Mm-hmm. So that only lasted one semester, but I really enjoyed it. I liked teaching. That was good.
Yeah.
That was a nice period.
So you did get your chance in the classroom.
Yeah.
So, 1948, you become a vice president at that time of General Linen. Your father is the president.
Yeah.
Well, tell me now about your early experiences with the company, because this, had you worked as a child, had you worked with your dad at all, or was this completely new for you?
Never. No, it was completely new, and, I had, my father had no formal education in Poland, or had, as to this very day, I kibitz, but this is the truth. We have a 4 or 5 committee that really runs the company, and then I'll come with various and sundry ideas, and 90%, maybe 95%, get shot down by this group. That's the way it is, but my job is to generate ideas and so forth. Anyway.
Well, let me ask one other thing, and then I want to go back to your early experiences in the business. Where did you live when you and Irene came back to Detroit in 1948?
Well, we started living with my folks, and then we bought a house on Hartwell and 7 Mile Road. And then I had my kids there, and then that house wasn't big enough for all 5 of us. Then we bought a house in Oak Park, because Oak Park was developing at that time, and their school system was good. I don't say it was outstanding, but it was a good school system, so that's what our concern was education. That still keeps popping back.
Where was the house, just for the record?
Which house?
In Oak Park.
I had 2 houses
in
Oak Park. You know where Oak Park Manor is?
No, I do not. I'm sorry.
You know where the golf course is on 10 Mile Road there?
Right.
opposite there, there's a little enclave. That was our second house. That was a two-story house. And I stayed in Oak Park because I was on the school board, and I didn't want to lose my job on the school board. So the first house was on Dartmouth, 12940 Dartmouth. Okay, say something, stick in the memory.
All right, well, tell me, please, about your early experiences with the company. In fact, what did you do first? I know you were made vice president. Did you start out as, what sort of actual task and work did you do? And how did you learn about the company?
Well, it's problem solving, you know, most of it is. And incidentally, the company was used by my father and our family as a stepping stone for the family. He had, he was the first of his family to come here, but one by one, as he could save up enough money for the fair, he brought over his entire family. Thank God, so they survived the Holocaust. Otherwise, you know, they'd have been with the rest of the corpses in Auschwitz.
How many people altogether? How many family members altogether did your father bring across?
He had
ballpark figure.
Five brothers, mother, father, and some peripheral relatives. So he brought them over one at a time, you know, as he could afford it. And as time went on, he could afford it better and quicker and so forth. So that was that. What I did in the business at first, I don't know that I could actually tell you what I did.
How about this? Could you also maybe describe the company at the time that you worked? How many employees?
I don't remember, but that was, see that picture there?
Mm-hmm.
Now that was the early building on Palmer, you know, and since then, of course, we've expanded, bought more property, and I see 3, 6, 7 vehicles there, so I presume one is a spare, so must have had 6 routes at that time. And these are small trucks. You know, the trucks we have now are 4 times that size. And we haul more material, of course.
So the idea that your father and his partner started with, delivery of linen supplies, was successful.
It caught on, yes, absolutely. It was needed. And as restaurants proliferated, markets were part of our market, and different products were added. These mats came later. This was a very lucrative addition. It didn't exist.
Floor mats. You cleaned and delivered.
Yes. That's, we do $1 million a year in floor mats now. Mm-hmm. That's a lot of money, a lot of floor mats. Anyway, so the business developed and expanded, and we continue to grow. We just started. We hired a man. That was a meeting Irene was telling me about. We started what we call a direct sales division. We hired this man to sell uniforms, sell them, and we don't process or handle them. We make the sale, we size them right, they pick the style, we get them embroidered properly, and this has got to be a great adjunct to the business, okay? Mm-hmm. And we now have a catalog with our name on it and so forth, so, you know, it keeps developing.
Mm-hmm.
But we're going to run out of life here shortly, sometime. So I got to I got to watch that.
What do you mean by that?
Well, I'm getting older, you know. I'm 85.
How long? I thought you meant the company.
No. The company is in good shape.